Texas Absolute Rally, powered by the Kielder Works team. Cordless tools tailored for the world of motorsport.
Hello everyone, welcome to Absolute Rally, episode 8, season 13. If you think it's going to be one of those programs, it probably is, in all honesty. And the reason why is because we're all back together again. We are basically the worst boy band in the world. I will say on my right, hello Trevor Agnew.
Hello Tony Simpson.
And I will say in the middle, hello Ryan Champion.
Hello Trevor Agnew and Tony Simpson.
Yeah, and on my left I'll say hello Jack Bengen.
Hello, I'm so excited by this occasion. I've dressed up in a tuxedo to record this podcast. I'm so excited to be back.
I'm glad you've made some kind of effort. Boys, we haven't been all together like this for about three seasons, I think it feels like. But certainly, Jack's been missing. Where have you been, Jack?
I've just done a doubleheader in Spa and Monza.
Right, okay. Some reason I had a completely different image when you started the doubleheader. Ryan Champion, have you been anywhere in particular? Yes, you have. You been in China, haven't you, somewhere?
I haven't been in China since we last spoke. Oh, yes, because you never invited us last week, did you?
No.
That's right. No. But again, you criticised us for not turning up when we weren't actually invited. So, yes, I have been in China. Little trip to China.
You do know I only criticise you to see whether you're actually listening.
Right, okay.
So,
we only actually listen when you criticise.
Thank you for the download, Ryan. Thank you for the download.
Did you go to China for the day?
No, not quite the day, but it felt like it.
To be fair, it felt like you were there. Should we ask why you were there? It sounded like you were... It sounded very mysterious.
Very mysterious. Yeah, you can do. I was doing an event for McLaren on the automotive side, a launch of a new car, so... China been quite an important market to them nowadays.
Trev, you been anywhere?
Just down to the beach.
Yeah, I haven't been anywhere. I went to Sainsbury's the other day. That was as good as it got, yeah. Yeah. I decided to break away from my usual Tesco shop and thought, you know what, I'm going to mix it up and go to Sainsbury's. So that's where I've been. Anyway, so we know where we've all been. There's been plenty going on, boys, even though we've had that little bit of downtime. We've got Rally Turkey, of course, coming up towards the end of next week. But there's various stories that I want to kind of get through and kind of shift our way through. We'll refer to Jack's paper as ever and the front page today, Jack Bengen. Tell us all about it so we can discuss it.
It's Marcus Gronholm and him potentially making a comeback to the WRC in Rally Sweden for his 50th birthday. So quite exciting. Apparently there was talks last year for Marcus to come back and drive a 2017 car, and they didn't quite materialise in the end. But him and Mackinnon have apparently spoken more recently about a deal for next year's event and Rally Sweden, obviously an event that Marcus has done many times and had a great deal of success on. So I think we'll all be pretty excited to see Marcus back, and hopefully we can have it'd be nice to see Tommy Mackinnon out as well, wouldn't it, if we could have the both of them. That'd be pretty cool.
That'd be amazing. And I'd really want to get who is the dog?
Mine.
Is it? And what's his name? Sorry, Trev.
It's Lottie.
Lottie. And is Lottie got an opinion on this?
Well, clearly she's very encouraged by it.
Okay. She's got a Lottie of opinions on it.
Leave it, Jack. Leave it. That's Sorry. Just awkward. Yeah, it's just awkward. Right. That's a tumbleweed nones. No, yep. It's nice to have Lottie on, but if I would have known Lottie was there, I would have introduced Lottie. That would have been probably the way to go, because I did introduce Johnny last week when he was on.
So, well, she wasn't here, and she just sort of made her presence known, that's all.
Trev, do you know when you get to 50, would you come back and do a rally again?
A bit late for that one. thanks. I did come back. What years was it when I come back? I made a comeback after 10 years for one rally. That would have been, 2013, so 5 years ago. I was 49, just short of it.
Okay, what did you do?
Martin Rowe and I competed in the Tempest Rally.
Of course.
In his father-in-law's Mark 1 Escort.
I remember that now. I remember that.
Do you?
Yeah, I do, actually. I do.
We were third quickest on the first stage, which was quite exciting. Second stage was really, really fast. Ran those the event, I think. And big press and all of that. Fantastic. 100 mile an hour. Third stage, into the first corner, front wheel comes off it. Now, you imagine if that had happened on the second stage and we had an airplane accident, which it would have been, that would have been our fault, wouldn't it?
It would have been, but I don't like to think about stuff like that. I don't. To me, that's not healthy. That would do me, to be honest with you. That would do me.
That's why I'm not competing. Okay. Yeah, I've done that now.
Okay. Ryan Champion, have you got something specific you would like to do for your 50th in rallying?
Something specific? No, I haven't thought that far ahead, to be honest.
It's not that far away now.
It probably isn't now you mention it. We're still a few years off. No, I'll have to think about that. I'll come up with a plan.
It does seem to be
an electric car, won't it?
It won't be.
No, never going to happen. No, it won't be. It'll be like a 109 octane turbo fuel.
Yeah.
Powered.
This seems to be a thing recently. Obviously, we remember you were canking and coming. Is it a Finnish thing as such to do something in rallying on your 50th birthday, boys?
A few of them did it, didn't they? Timo Salonen did it.
Marco Lehn.
Yeah.
Vatanen.
Yeah. Remember Vatanen doing it. I remember Kankinen, of course, did it, didn't he? I seem to remember Kankinen in that black Focus.
Yep.
Yeah.
I think Gronham's got the right idea. He's going to do Sweden because he reckons it'd be more fun and he would be more competitive there as well, I think.
Okay. So it's not a full time return to WRC, but it would be great to see him back. But it should be great to see any of the legends back, really, wouldn't it? You know, it's providing we don't. And again, we keep on coming back to this, providing it doesn't stop any of the young guns coming through. There's almost, do you think of the way you kind of like a senior thing? Maybe there needs to be like a senior WRC, anybody over a certain age.
I think we've got enough problems with the classes we have got in WRC. We don't need to be adding any more.
Well, funny you should say that, Jack Benny. You led me very conveniently by the hand to course of the story about WRC2 and how that could be now split in two. Tell us about it, Jack.
I like leading you by the hand, Tony.
Do you know?
So, yeah. The WRC is looking to it is reevaluating its class system and is going to decide whether the WRC should be just the WRC2 championship should just be for private drivers and there should be some sort of separate championship for manufacturers and stuff with the idea of trying to get more people into the sport at a lower cost, I guess. But I don't know, it feels a bit like
the horse and bolted.
It seems a bit speculative to me. I think is the word I'm looking for. I just don't. There doesn't seem to be a lot of sort of explanation as to how they're going to do this properly and how it's going to bring the cost down, how it's going to get more people involved. It's just we'd like to get more people involved. It doesn't really strike me as a sort of an action plan as to how they're going to do it. It's just what they'd like to do.
Trev, we had, of course, John Armstrong on as guest host last week, as we promised. And of course, John is a man that's a young man rather that's trying to do this. And I think whether he mentioned on the podcast or when we were chatting, but he was saying, you know, the way in has got to be in with one of the proper teams, one of the best teams. And of course, that's something that, you know, you're a big advocate of course. You know, as the horse already bolted on this with regards to WRC2, because, you know, the clearly you want to go to motorsport car, you want an M sport car. You know, people are not wanting to go to privateer teams, are they?
But would it change things? You know, if you're coming in to do the championship, I don't know. They need to look at the whole structure of everything around WRC. Just a quick question. When did you win your BBC Four trophy? When was that?
BBC Four trophy. I won that in 2016.
2016.
Yeah.
And, well, I think you missed a trick this year, to be honest. So, WRC3, if you had went to Mexico.
Yeah. I know where you're going with this.
Finished. If you had went to Argentina and finished,
yeah,
you would have had 50 points most two events. If you went to Australia and finished, you'd have another 25 points. And then between GB and Spain, you probably only need 25 points between those two to be WRC3 champion.
I reckon logistically that would have been somewhere in the region of about 45 grand.
Well, you can hire cars there. You only need to finish, remember? You could even have taken Jack Binion as a co-driver.
Hasn't somebody tried to do exactly what you've just described?
Somebody might have done. I tried to
happen,
do this.
It's happened many years. Many years that's been happening.
Yeah. I seem to think there's a young lady that springs to mind, Jack.
The problem with WRC2, right, is that the being in a manufacturer team doesn't mean you get a miles better car than anybody else, but it's the testing. They can do hundreds of miles of testing before the events, which you know, we've talked about this before, like Frederick Arlen, for example, very quick driver and has proven himself at, you know, various national levels, but he's not got the money to go and do 200 miles of testing before he goes out to Mexico or Argentina to do an event. And that's why it's, you know, advantageous to be in a manufacturer car. Obviously, you get instant access to the parts and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, the whole point of R5s is that they should be relatively simple and it's fairly easy to get the parts. So the problem with WRC2 is the testing. And then the problem from that is, how do you stop people testing? Because if they, you know, the likes of Tiedemann, if you say you're not allowed to test, he'll just go and do 3 or 4 events or, you know, 5 events before his WRC2 event. So it's a difficult situation to try and stop what's going on there and try and develop that. And I'm not really sure what the answer is.
No, but even, you know, let's use John, of course, right? He was on with us last week, somebody you've been working with on a secret project, which we can't talk about. But, you know, John, of course, had to do kind of a little bit of, you know, crowdfunding to do his German test. So, you know, it's not always a given. Even when you are on a supported car, you're going to get testing. You've still got to pay for it.
Yeah, I mean, obviously that was a prize drive that John had rather than, you know, a works drive, as it were. But, you know, most of these works drives are, or a lot of them are funded as well, aren't they?
It was works blessed. It was works blessed, right?
Thanks.
Yeah.
And, you know, what difference does it make ultimately? How is it going to lower the cost by having two separate championships? If you have a manufactured R5 championship and a private R5 championship, what difference does it make? You know, it's still going to cost the same. You're not going to reduce costs, and that's the only way you're going to encourage more people in there. You know, when I saw somewhere that, the FIA are going to try and increase privateer participation or whatever it was, I thought, oh, great, they're going to allow B13 cars or something, because that's about the only way you do it. Allow people to turn up in an Evo and a Subaru and do a 45-mile rally and maybe call it the BTRDA championship. You know, seems to...
Do you know what?
It's more interesting.
You've just said something. I had a conversation with someone who I won't name because it's not fair on them, who is reasonably well connected and well known in rallying this morning. And we
wasn't Trevor Agnew then.
It wasn't, no. Reasonably well connected. Anyway, and we were talking about BRC and their opinion, and this is somebody who's been around the sport longer than all of us, was we need to just make it like the British Open again, and let's just let it go. It's kind of the similar principle. What you've, you know, the only way we're going to get numbers in is basically to remove the restrictions that are in place.
I mean, it's getting to that stage, isn't it? Unfortunately, where people just cannot afford to run homologated cars, and we've you know, we've talked about this to death, and it doesn't really matter. We tried going down the front wheel drive route at a national level, but R5 cars are expensive, whether it's at a British level or a world level. They are very, very expensive cars to run. And, you know, just getting back to Jack's point, I think you're always going to be at an advantage if you're in an official car, if you like, a works R5 car, because you're going to have the latest spec and dare I say, the latest maps. Because if you're a customer and your car's guaranteed to go away and do whatever it is, you know, 2,000 kilometres, 3,000 kilometres, I don't know what the engine rebuilds are, but your map for that engine is probably going to be slightly different than if you can rebuild the engine every rally, I would suggest. So there's always going to be an advantage to be had by the factory running an R5 car over a complete privateer car. But, you know, they keep coming up with these ideas. What happened to the idea we heard about a few weeks ago of putting a 34mm restrictor in a top line world rally car to introduce more privateer entries? That didn't happen, did it? There was a cup for the previous generation world rally cars, and we had one or two world rally cars turn up because they're all so expensive.
You forgot about R4.
Oh yes, and then there's R4, yes, to reduce cost, of course.
We can have an R4 now. There's an R4 there.
A 500X, Fiat 500X.
Yeah. Have we been a bit harsh on this?
No.
Oh. Okay, all right.
It's still going to cost a small fortune. You're still going to be up to nearly R5 money without R5 performance.
But how about rebuilds?
Well, the whole point of an R5 car is it's supposed to be cheap to rebuild, isn't it?
Yeah, no. Haven't seen some rebuilding.
No, they're not cheap in the slightest.
No, not in practice, I don't know.
No, I'll tell you what, right, before you carry on, right, sorry to interrupt, right, we've all had our little rants with regards to R4. One person we've not asked is Trevor Agnew. Trevor Agnew, R4. Away you go.
Why do you need it? load of nonsense. Understand it might need to be something between R2 and R5, but that's not the way to go. I think Ryan cut it off, something like that, the last time we talked about it. No need for any more talk. Let's move on.
And clearly there's a need for something between R2 and R5 because you've got numbers in between. So, you know, why have R2 and R5 if you're not going to use 3 and 4?
But I'm sure I saw this week as well about R5 plus, so something in between. Yeah. That is too big of a jump from R5 to World Rally Cars. This sounds like people talking in the airport, just having a chat over coffee. Yeah. We've yet to see Yves Matton sit down and say, right, okay, this is the plan for the next 5 years. That needs to happen, number one, to make sure we've got manufacturers involved. Number two, what a load of nonsense about a leap up from R5 to World Rally Car. Look at Lappi last year. Right. He won Finland first time out. Look at Sunnan. Look at any of them.
And it's from R2 to R5. The good drivers make the jump, no problem.
Of course they do.
There you go. I think we've just sorted that out, boys. I think we've just sorted that out. But speaking of R5, there was that image that kind of got bounced around over the last probably 4 or 5 days on various social media platforms of the VW testing. And just an image of a VW R5 Polo with its rear beam approximately half a mile away from it. I think that's the best way to describe it. And testing to destruction. Ryan Champion or failure of a component?
Well, if you give them the benefit of the doubt, it was a failure of a component after it had been tested to destruction. This is social media, isn't it? This is what happens now. We all see everything that happens. In years gone by, you would never have seen a Subaru when Colin had taken a corner out of it on a test, or a corner had simply fallen out of it, or Carlos in a Focus or whatever it might have been, because there wasn't somebody there snapping every picture and uploading it. So, it's been a very public failure for them. They've obviously gone on record saying that they were doing durability testing, the whole car was over mileage, and they were just running it to see what breaks. And that's what everybody's done for years with rally cars. And yeah, I think you've got to give them the benefit of the doubt. The car's done so many miles now that I can't imagine they're having fundamental issues now. So I think, yes, something broke. It was on rough terrain, and maybe it was up to maximum mileage. They'd certainly be putting the homologation back very, very quickly if that was just a fundamental failure, I would have thought.
Trev, I wouldn't mind your take on this one. The supposed driver lineup for Rally Spain were MN, Jack's paper, predicted that they would be making their debut in Spain. There's been a few drivers that have been muted, Pontus Tiedemann and Petter Solberg and possibly Erik Kamali as all possibilities. Probably Pontus is probably guaranteed. Probably the second car has probably got the question mark against it with the latter two. Where does this kind of sit, you know, and I'll get Rye's take on it as well, of course, because you guys obviously have worked within the bag group, as it were, over the years. How does this kind of work? Obviously, Pontus has been a Skoda driver so long, you know, Skoda Motorsport's reputation is through the roof at the moment with their R5 program. All of a sudden, Big Brother comes along and decides, we want a piece of this.
Yeah, it's interesting that crossover between Tiedemann, the Skoda driver, moving into the Volkswagen. But going back to what you're saying about the reliability side of things, that, you know, it won't matter at the end of the day. It's Volkswagen Motorsport. The resources they have are incredible. Their showroom is going to be Rally Spain. So they're going to put in the best drivers to show just how competitive the car is. Reliability, it won't be an issue, let's face it. You know, it's been built on the back of Skoda Fabia R5 car. It went to Sardinia. I remember being there the first event and one of the roughest rallies and never missed a beat. Again, something else that you can get with a factory team. They'll fire parts at it all the time. So from a reliability point of view, it's going to be there. From a competitive point of view, it's going to be there. You just need the right drivers in it. And sure, it'd be good to have Solberg in it, but I reckon definitely Tiedemann, because he's done a lot of the testing. Camley's driven as well, I believe. Is that right, Jack?
Yeah,
he's driven on tarmac. Yeah. So, yeah, two competitive drivers, getting them in there, and let's have a go at it. They've certainly got plenty of orders for it for the national championships.
Just with regards to that, though, with the kind of the Skoda and the Volkswagen thing, do we see... we've talked about this repeatedly. The two brands don't normally go toe to toe. You know, back in the day of early 90s, of course, we did have Skoda, we had Seat going toe-to-toe WRC level, and of course, with the F2 programs for Seat and Volkswagen, and of course, even they had the big Octavia at one point. But the brands don't normally go toe-to-toe, and I think it's quite interesting.
No, it's true. You know, normally one will go rallying, one will be Le Mans, one will be, you know, whatever it'll be. But remember, this is in a factory team. It's a preparation company. Volkswagen Motorsport have got a facility there. What else would they be doing at this point apart from rallycross? So I don't know if it's something that they're committed to having the premises or committed to having something or some sort of a compromise when they decided to pull out of rallying that these guys would stay on. But I don't think it's a long-term thing. They're certainly going to prove the R5 car is good, but I don't see it as a long-term thing with Volkswagen Motorsport preparing R5 cars. It certainly doesn't seem to me like it's going, well, it's a commercial thing going forward at the minute, but I don't think long-term it's going to be there.
Jack, maybe this whole thing of maybe having a two-tier WRC2 thing, if Volkswagen Motorsport are not going to be there as a team, and maybe Skoda are, maybe, you know, your top privateer will be in a Volkswagen.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? We've seen the likes of Citroën and Peugeot have two-tiered programs with R5s, and not really, I mean, that didn't really work because both the cars weren't particularly good, but there never seemed to be a direction there, did there? And this one's difficult to see as well. No, we haven't heard anyone from Skoda or Volkswagen come out and explain what they're thinking behind this, having you know, two cars from the same group competing against each other effectively for commercial reasons. So it's an interesting one to see how that plays out. I think there'll be absolutely no problem with that VW. It's been designed by Francois Xavier de Maison, who's responsible for designing the most successful rally car in the history of the WRC. So there'll be absolutely no problems with that car, and it'll be absolutely rapid when it comes out. I've got no doubt about that.
There you go. We'll watch this space. We'll be interested to see what happens, of course, in Spain. Another story by the way, guys, you don't realise this, but later on the podcast, I did a piece with Patrick Sandell, and we touched upon because the guys from the gravel crew and I got a little bit giddy when we were talking about Super 1600 last week. And of course, Patrick Sandell, who won the Junior World Rally Championship in the sexy Renault Clio, we kind of got a little bit excited talking about Super 1600 again. But the Junior World Championship is going to continue with M Sport in 2019, along with Pirelli and Panther Fuels. So that's going to remain with M Sport. So there is going to be some continuity there. And I know Matic, Trev, is being very, 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 very vocal with regards to just how tight the teams are this year and how good the driver level is. And I just hope, you know, we can continue that, because the juniors has been such a great feeder ground.
It has over the years, certainly in the early days of JWRC, when you've got Loeb and Sordo and Meek and all those guys coming through at that point, PG Anderson, Guy Wilkes, all that. Is it the same now? There's certainly plenty over the last 3-4 years that have won it or been very competitive and disappeared. You know, French drivers usually won through because of the support of the government body, the FFSA. So they usually got a budget, the contingency, or certainly it was the first stage of an investment for another 2-3 years if they got that, but you know, if they got that mark. But that seems to have disappeared a little bit now. I'm not sure if it's still as good as it was back in the day that you were talking about.
Right. For somebody, you know, I think you got involved in a little bit of the chats last week with regards to Super 1600, of course, because you drove one. But what's your thoughts on obviously the one make platform now for the JWRC is a well-trodden one. Do you think it lacks or gains something having effectively a one make championship as opposed to different R2s there from different manufacturers?
No, I think it definitely gains something from it, because it's, albeit very expensive, it is still, there is still a prize structure there, there's prize money there, there's something to actually go for and a reward at the end of it. And we've talked at length about the various one-mate championships over the years, and you know, a one-mate championship is always a great way to get your name out there, to prove yourself in equal equipment to your rivals. And so I think any one mate championship is a great thing, and particularly at world championship level, that until recent years had never been there. And if you look at the Super 1600 days that you talked about, it wasn't really a level playing field. You know, some cars were significantly better than others, and some of the teams were significantly better funded than the others as well. So whilst you had the various manufacturers in there in those days, it certainly wasn't a level playing field, but some of those drivers were able to move with those manufacturers through to WRC drives. But I think now with the World Junior Championship, it's probably working the best it has done for a while. And as we touched on this, I think a couple of weeks ago, that it's almost now removed the national level from rallying. So people are literally going from R2 at maybe a national level rather than then competing at the top level of, say, the British Championship or Finnish or French Championship. They move straight to the WRC with a World Mate Championship. Now, that's not great for the strength of the national championships, but I guess ultimately if your aim is to be in the World Championship for the long haul, the sooner you can get there, the better.
Absolutely. Do you know what? I think even Patrick and I would talk about this a little bit later on, but it's just come to me now, and whether we did talk about it, whether I thought I must talk about that. The Super 1600s back then, the way you just described with the teams and stuff like that, feels a little bit what we've just been talking about with WRC 2 now.
Yes, it probably is. I think you had more variation in the cars because you had this alleged €100,000 price cap. I mean, you know, take the Puma, for example. The Puma was very much engineered towards that €100,000, and then Peugeot came in with the, whatever it was, the 206 at the time, and Renault with the Clio, and you could buy a kit for €100,000, or you want the proper one.
Yeah,
I know that'll cost you about 130 or 140, and then you have to build it. And then of course we saw effectively like the full works teams with the likes of Suzuki. I mean, when Suzuki came in, they weren't just building a car for customers. They were a full works team all the way through, and didn't really sell that many customer cars. So, I guess you're right. It's similar to what we see at R5 level now, other than I think R5 cars are more at a similar level, you know, albeit, you know, maybe you could argue the 208 and the DS3 weren't quite at the same level, but then they won national championships as well. And, you know, we saw Craig Breen do very well in one. But, yeah, I think R5 cars would generally be at a similar level, but you can't beat in a being in a factory team, that's for sure.
No, I guess not. Jack, your thoughts on it remaining with M Sport and as a one, because you've probably been closer probably to all the lads, you know, certainly the Brits and Irish that have done it over the last 5 or 6 years. Has it proved to what, you know, what we thought it was going to be? You know, I'm thinking about, obviously, we know Elvin won it a few years back now, a good few years back as a JWRC, and of course then it turned to DMAC Drive, and I'm thinking about the likes of Oshin, and I'm thinking, you know, the likes of probably Tom Cave, and then more Rob Duggan recently. You know, I suppose, you know, their careers have stalled, I suppose, a little bit, and you know, that's nothing against the championship as such, but perhaps it hasn't quite gave the springboard that we all hoped it would.
Yeah, maybe not, but you know, I think that's as much a problem of how much it costs to do that next step, isn't it? You know, we've seen Rob Duggan have that outing in the R5 recently, and was very impressive in Donegal, but he's not got the money to do it, and you know, that's ultimately the problem. Motorsport's always been an expensive sport, and you know, it's not you know, it probably has got more expensive over the years. It's not a new problem to anyone, is it? But yeah, the lack of this kind of ladder that we've been talking about, where you've got a graduated path to the WRC, is a, you know, a massive problem for people like that. But yeah, in answer to your question, I think the JWRC is a good championship. I think they've had a little bit of, you know, unreliability with the cars, but they seem to be sort of sorting that out as the development of the, you know, the 1 litre engine goes. It's still a little bit expensive for my liking, really, I think, but you know, if you're going to go and compete at a world championship level, it's probably about, you know, reflective of the other classes in terms of how much it costs. But yeah, you know, ideally, you know, you're getting on for nearly $200,000 to do the JWRC properly with testing and, you know, your time away and all that kind of stuff. So it is very expensive.
But if you're fast in Turkey, in whatever, Jack Benyon, you get the use of a boat.
A big boat.
A big boat, where you can take all your friends. Have you seen this story?
That's a nice gesture.
I'm not offering it, that's not me. But there's this story that's broke from the organisers of Turkey, that you get use of a 47-metre super yacht. Not just a yacht, Jack, a super yacht.
Well, if there's anything better than a yacht, it's a super yacht.
It is. It is. And it basically, anything, if you put super before anything, it makes it better. Didn't you know that?
No.
No, clearly not.
Funnily enough, I did see that Nicholas Jules-Sewell did tweet Thierry Neuville last night just to ask if he'd upgraded his license, his boating license, that is, just in case he won the rally.
I love it. Right, boys, we're heading really, really quickly out of this section, of course. But I just wanted to just talk about things a little bit closer to home again. We are being a little bit parochial, but the news about Rally Isle of Man, which broke over the last kind of 48 hours, really. I think I want to come to you first, Ry, and get your take on it. For those of you who don't know, unfortunately, Rally Isle of Man was going to be the next round of the British Rally Championship over here. Of course, you've heard us all talk about the Isle of Man probably repeatedly over the years of doing this podcast and on previous podcasts as well. But the Manx is special. We all know the Manx is special. It was going to be the next round. There's been some issues supposedly with regards to safety concerns from the Manx government. They'd issued a couple of things with regards to what they wanted for health and safety reasons prior to the road closing permits to be issued. Fast forward on about 48 hours ago, 72 hours ago, the organisers decided to effectively pull the pin on the event because they said that they couldn't get the road closure permits in time now. I'm paraphrasing quite a lot. You can search this stuff out. But, Ryan, I'm sure you've kept up to speed with it. What's your take on it?
Well, firstly, it's a sad situation. And, you know, I think the follow-up to that is, as a lot of us saw, that it was on social media, on Twitter, that actually the Manx government or the transport officials actually went on record and did like a 10-minute interview saying they want the rally to run.
I've watched it. It's a weird thing.
I've never seen anything like that. Never seen government officials saying, look, we want the rally to run. Look, we're willing to do whatever it takes to make the rally run. And yet the organisers had gone on record saying that they were at fault. And it was an unbelievable thing to hear, really. But regardless of why or how, it's a sad state of affairs for a number of reasons. Firstly, as far as the British Rally Championship is concerned, the crown jewel. It's always been our Monte Carlo rally. It's an incredible rally, very tough event to do. It's seen the Vatanens, the Toivonens, the Mikulas, Kankinens. They've all been there and done it. And it's a unique challenge, one that for me is a very, very important part of the British Rally Championship. But it's also expensive. It always has been, you know, with the ferry costs and logistics of getting there. So the entries have dropped off year on year. And when things like this happen, it just means it's only ever going to be more difficult for the rally to come back again. We saw something similar a couple of years ago. And every time this happens, for me, it's just taking another big piece out of the wall. And, you know, I think it'd be very hard, unfortunately, for the Manx Rally or Rally Isle of Man, as it is now, to come back from this. And, you know, we heard, unfortunately, the government officials talking about safety plans not being in place and that maybe the organisers hadn't done what they should have done by this point. Now, I don't know whether that's a true reflection, but what I do know is when we had Mark Higgins on, you know, a year or so ago, 2 years ago, was it now, he did it in the R5 car. He was talking about catching the course car on a stage and doing loops of the same section of the stage and things that would never have happened on the Manx in years gone by. As Trevor will say, it was always a fabulous rally to do, always very well run. And I think these organisational issues have been coming for a couple of years in terms of, you know, the way stages have run, etc. So it's a very, very sad state of affairs because, as I said, for me, it's a huge part of the British Rally Championship.
Trev, what's your take on it?
Yeah, I echo everything that Ryan said. I had a huge affinity to the rally. Used to go there on holidays, so the chance to go and compete on the event with the history and heritage that Ryan's been talking about was absolutely brilliant. It wasn't a great hunting ground for me. I think I did it four times and never finished it. The biggest disaster was in 2000 when half a mile into the first stage, the engine on our Aster blew up and lost the British Championship. But I'm surprised. You know, in the days that Ryan's talking about, you had Richard Bardry, John Skinner, all these guys who are fantastic. Like, that would never have happened. It was just so switched on. It took everything to a whole new level. The PR when the Ruffman's days were there, incredible. I just can't understand how the Manx National has ran successfully over the last couple of years. The Rally Isle of Man isn't the only rally on the island. So what is it that's going wrong with these safety plans or whatever the issue is for this particular rally and this particular set of organisers and the government? Is it the relationships broken down? Is there a lack of trust? I don't know what it is. It doesn't matter, as Rand says. It's just a travesty at an event like that and the history that goes with it. Is going to struggle, because who's going to have the trust in it next year? Especially those Japanese competitors and just even a marshal who lives in Liverpool and wants to go across, and he's given up his holidays to go there, he's booked the ferries, booked the hotels. It's very hard to get those people's trust back, I think.
I couldn't agree more. Jack, I'm sure you've been all over it, obviously from an official point of view and obviously from your own personal point of view. How far away off on what we've just been saying are we from the truth, do you think?
I think it'll be difficult to ever know, not being in those meetings between the organiser and the government, and both of them contradicting each other in their statements. So it's going to be very difficult to work out what's actually happened. But, you know, the bottom line is, it's just a very sad state of affairs for the competitors, the marshals, all the volunteers who've paid to go over. As Trevor said, you know, some people are going to be 200, 300, 400, 500 quid out of pocket for this. And it's all down to poor organisation, whether that's the government, whether it's the event. You know, it's difficult to say because, you know, like I've said already, they've both contradicted each other. The government have said, we really want this event to run and we'll do anything we can to make it run. And the organisers have said, the government won't give us our road closure permit. So trying to work out what's actually happening there is very difficult. But really, it has to take a back seat at this point to think about those people who, you know, we talked so much about how expensive rallying is and, you know, how difficult it is to do these days. And some of these people are going to be, you know, not just the volunteers and the marshals and people like that. It's the competitors as well, the co-drivers and the drivers and the friends of those crews. And Trevor mentioned the three Japanese drivers who come over as well in their minis, and they have to send their cars out months in advance, and they've had to pay bigger fees this year because of what happened at the end of July, where the event was in doubt then. You know, the Japanese drivers couldn't send their cars out because they weren't sure if the event was going to go ahead, and as soon as it was, they had to pay extra to get the cars shipped over. So yeah, just a real nightmare situation really for everyone involved, and it's very sad. And I think they'll very much struggle to run the event next year, because who's going to put their entry in knowing what's happened this year, it won't happen again next year.
There's a couple of things that strike me, and again, I've read both sides, and I think, you know, the guys from the Isle of Man government were saying, you know, we didn't issue road closing permits until the day of the event last year, so, you know, they could still be issued now. What I, and this is my personal opinion, and by all means, anyone shoot me down, and any one of you three, or by any means anyone listening and stuff like that, it basically has the concerns for me is that it was entries. Now, whether they've used the excuse to get out of it because they were going to make a huge loss on trying to run this rally as around the BRC, we know the numbers are drastically reduced, dare I say dire, for a BRC round, and you can't run an event on 10 cars or 12 cars, or what it would have probably ended up being. And again, that's unfortunate due to the fact that the way the calendar has been so expensive for people that they've had to pick and choose, and they've had such expensive events on the bounce. And unless people can afford, you know, tens of thousands of pounds, the likelihood is they were never going to go to these events if they didn't need to go to them. And I think that is been a domino effect onto the event by the entries, and I think possibly the events looked at the entries and thought, we're going to make a massive loss, and all of a sudden people are now maybe starting to realise that you can't run a rally as a business.
It's a difficult one. I don't know if it's, you know, obviously we've not seen, you can look at the entry list, so you can have a look who's on it. They had 114 entries as far as I know up until the point where they cancelled the event, 83 of which had paid, so you've got that gap between the 83 and the 114. But, you know, the BRC this year, we've talked a lot about entries and stuff, and yes, the R5s are down, and it's not looking particularly good, but they're only taking one or two or three cars less because they've got so many more R2s this year. So I don't think, you know, I doubt it would have been a massive difference to last year's Isle of Man, but obviously we don't know that.
Would have been interesting to see. I, you know, if by all means, if I'm wrong, then I'll take it back. And, you know, I'm only going on roughly what the R5s were and then looking, you know, what R2s are starting to kind of drop out now. But I can't see beyond kind of that number of maybe 10 to 15 cars, to be honest. But, you know, again, I will check. And if I'm wrong, I do take it back. But, again, you know, just talking about the Japanese crews, this is something I work with some Japanese teams, for WRC. And I know what it costs to get cars into Europe. And, you know, to get those three cars here, they're probably somewhere in the region of probably about 25-30 grand down round trip.
Yeah, it's an incredible number, isn't it? You just can't even comprehend what, you know, these people coming out to have some fun and enjoy a good, what is usually a good rally. And yeah, it's just, it's unbelievable that you would be that far out of pocket, isn't it?
It is. It is. So just very, very quickly, and again, this isn't to kick BRC, but you guys have ran a story today, Jack, with regards to West Cork obviously being announced as a round, and also they're trying to get track rod back, perhaps as the penultimate round now of BRC for 2019.
Yeah, track rod's not going to happen. Absolute rally exclusive, I can tell you that now. There won't be a BRC presence on the track rod this year, so no replacement for the Isle of Man, and it'll just be five rounds counting, so no drop scores, which obviously is a bit tough when you've got Rally GB on the calendar. But it looks like they're trying to, you know, make a few changes for next year. Obviously, we've not got a full confirmation on the calendar. That'll be next week. But at the minute, we can say West Cork will be joining. That can only be a good thing in terms of the R5s, because obviously it's going to be a crossover between the Irish Tarmac Championship and the British Rally Championship, which is something that's been lacking. I think we've had the Ulster every year since the BRC returned in 2016, but we did have the Circuit of Ireland, which had both, and that had a good entry. I think the good entry there was obviously due to the fact that the Circuit of Ireland is a brilliant event. It's a European Championship round as well. Very, very well-known event and brilliant stages. But, you know, you've got to hope that having an event like West Cork has got to attract some of the Irish guys to do the BRC, and hopefully some of the BRC guys to do the Irish Tarmac Championship, because David Bogie's been one person who's been evaluating whether he wants to go and do the Irish Tarmac Championship next year. And you've got to hope that there's, you know, there's crossover in both ways, because the Irish Tarmac Championship numbers have been even more worrying than the British Rally Championship numbers, to be perfectly honest. So to have a bit of you know, support between those two events and to strengthen those two championships would be very good for national rallying, for sure.
I think so. Boys, that's the end of this section. We are going to be back with our any other businesses, but in the meantime, we're going to go to a little break, and then we're going to go to a chat that I had with Subaru USA star, as I say, I mentioned before, former Junior World Rally champion Patrick Sandell, and we talk about a few things about his career and also what he's up to at the moment.
This is Absolute Rally, powered by the Kielder Works team. Cordless tools tailored for the world of motorsport. Developed from hands-on knowledge that you only get in the service park, not the boardroom. The range of Kielder cordless impact wrenches are designed to be compact, lightweight, feel good, and crucially, get the job done. Kits are available for less than £160. Plus, exclusively for Absolute Rally listeners, use discount code RALLY for 10% off at www.kielder.co. Simply search Kielder Tools online.
And welcome back to Absolute Rally, and welcome back to a guest. Again, I keep saying this, it's somebody we've been trying to get on for a little while. Unfortunately, due to the guys at Subaru USA, they've put us in contact, they've hooked us up, and we've got Patrick Sandell. Patrick, welcome to Absolute Rally.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's really the irony is, Patrick, we genuinely have been trying to get you for a while, and then we had a guest on last week, and we all got quite excited and quite passionate, because we always like to look back at rallying as much as we like to look forward, and of course with Rallycross as well. But we were talking about Super 1600s, and we all got really, really excited about Super 1600s, and then I thought, God, we're going to be speaking to Patrick, the man who possibly the sexiest looking Super 1600, I have to say, who won a junior world championship in it, the Renault Clio, which was just stunning.
Yeah. Oh, man, that was, except where I'm at right now with Subaru, I would say that was the highlight of my career. I drove the junior world championship in Super 1600 Renaults for two seasons. And just the way those cars handle and the power and the sound. And I just remember in Finland, you know, you were on the rev limiter for 30 seconds on a stage, just wow. Like a bee. It was insane. So much fun.
Wow. It's just that we tend to forget now, just again, it's hindsight is a wonderful thing, as we always say, and we didn't realize how good we probably had at the Junior World Championship. Of course, back in those days, had several manufacturers all vying, very similar, I suppose, now to WRC2, where you had several manufacturers all supporting drivers. You know, you think about what Citroën did, and obviously Ford tried to support certain drivers. Suzuki, certainly, we had Chris Atkinson, of course, the other week, talking about how his program was supported by Suzuki in the Asia Pacific series. But we had that, and it was something very, very special. And it was all you guys, you know, young guns at the time, all going tooth and nail in these just stunning sounding little cars.
Yeah, no, it was such an amazing feeling. And in the year I won, the competition was crazy high. We had Chris Meek, PJ Anderson, Guy Wilkes, Urmo Aava from Estonia. So there were some really, really fast drivers there. And I think the reason why maybe I won that year was that I was able to put it together. I was not the fastest guy in the beginning of the year. Okay, I was second in Rally Sweden straight off. But everybody were so competitive, and the speed was insane. And yeah, we were pushing those cars quite a bit.
Well, we'll hop around your career a little bit, Patrick, because, you know, as I always say, I'm not a journalist. I'm a rally fan. I just remember this era kind of so, so well. But how does winning the Junior World Rally Championship, how does that end up with a man winning bronze and silver medals in the X Games? How does that even happen?
So I drove rally for, you know, most of my career. And then it was the year 2011 when I got a drive with ProDrive and Mini, and it was the same year they backed out. So in the beginning of that year, I was promised to get 8 rounds, and I had to found the 2 first myself, which I did. Wow. So we did Sweden and Portugal, but then the remaining 6 rallies went to 4 and went to 2 and went to 0 because at the moment the support from Mini and BMW was going away. So it was not ProDrive that promised me the drive. It was directly from Mini that they would support me. But in the same year, they just pulled out more and more and more. And at that moment, I felt that I was all the way up there, but I knew I needed to go home and collect all the money one more time and try to do it all over again to try to prove that I was worth a factory drive. And at the same time, I was looking at what was happening in the States with rallycross and how it started to develop to something really cool. And a Swedish guy named Andreas Eriksson that is running the Oldsburg MSC team. I talked to him because he was running cars over there with Tanne Faust and Brian Deegan. And we started to talk, and he asked if I was interested to come and join him for a test. And I did. And I was just blown away by the speed of the cars and the horsepowers. And then the year after, I thought, okay, let's give this a try and see, because I kind of felt I could stay in like WRC2 for forever and ever, but I always wanted more. I wanted to be competitive on the very highest level. And at that moment in Sweden, 2012, it was not possible to find the money that we needed to put together a full drive in WRC. And I knew that I need to found more or less a full season with someone backing me or sponsors to get a fair chance, because it's not hard. It's not easy to put yourself in and be able to show your speed if you not get a full season. And it was not possible at that moment. And then the rallycross door opened up, and here I am.
Do you feel, were you part of, because what's happened is, of course, quite recently, just going back to WRC for a second, you know, the management teams have come about again, a bit like what happened probably in the early 90s, where obviously you've got Timo Jokke and then you've got even management and companies like that now, where they've got stables of drivers. Were you part of a stable of drivers, or were you out there kind of trying to find this yourself, or did you have people behind you as well?
No, I say I was just in between the two epochs of managements like that. So I worked my ass off from day one to find sponsor money, and I have had a lot of people around me supporting me along the way. But in the end of the day, I never had like a manager or someone that found sponsors for me. I have had some incredible people support me, and sponsors have been for me for more or less my whole life. But I had to put it together all myself. And we can go back already to when I started rallying. It was the same thing. Like I had to do the hard work myself to get it going.
I just find that staggering, and I'm not just saying it because we're speaking now, but EWRC, which is just a great source, you click on that, and I've just clicked on that as we were speaking, to be honest, and you look at the cars that you drove, looking back at like 2008, 2009, you know, we've got Skoda Super 2000s, we've got the Peugeot Super 2000, we've got Group N cars, of course, you know, good old Subaru in there as well, the STIs, and there's just so many drives that you must, as you say, you more than work your ass off, you more than deserved it just on effort alone.
Yeah, no, and you know, I think it, like that mentality, my dad growed into my head when I was 15 years old. So my dad used to rally back in the 70s only in Sweden, and then as a kid I only played ice hockey. But when I was like 15, instead of bringing me to rallies and having me watch other people drive, I actually got to try a car myself, and a lower version of rallycross in Sweden called Folkrace. And then I told my dad that I really would like to try rallying, and he said, okay, but then you need to find money to go and buy a car, and then I can be your mechanic and I can support you with tires and fuel. So I went to McDonald's in my local town in northern Sweden the day after and told the manager that I need £2,500 because I'm going to buy my first rally car, and when can I start? So I guess he saw some kind of motivation in this young 16-year-old kid. So I think I started on the French fry the day after, after school. And after I earned about half of that, he actually sponsored me with the rest. So then I also had my first sponsor. That was the local McDonald's.
Wow.
And they stayed with me for 8 years, I think. So wow. That was how it all started.
I wonder how many rally drivers over the years have started in McDonald's, because it is one of those kind of go-to places, isn't it? I was wondering how many kind of people started flipping burgers, but to keep them as well for another 8 years. And I looking back, as I can relate to some of the cars you drove. I'm a few years older than you, but not many. I can relate to the Group M front wheel drive cars, because that's kind of what I drove when I was growing up as well. And you know how easy they are to maintain, because of course you can just go and buy stock parts and things like that. Makes life so much easier, and you think you can be harder on the car and things like that, but you always want that more speed and you always want that little bit more effort. How did the relationship with the Clio start? Just, I know we mentioned about the Super 1600, but you did kind of 2 years in the Clio, didn't you?
So so from the beginning, I started off with a Volkswagen Golf GTI from 79 that I drove for many years, actually. If you're looking on kids now, they want to change to an all-wheel driven car after a year. But I think I drove that first car for like 4 or 5 years, and then after that I switched to a Seat Ibiza Group N, and after that the Group N Clio to drive in the Swedish National Championship. And we also started to go, we went down and did Rally Bar, I mean Czech Republic and things like that, to start to get some more experience. But back in Sweden then the competition was again crazy high. PJ Anderson was driving there with me, and then he came up to the Junior World Championship a few years earlier than me, but it was great effort. I was backed by Renault Sweden, and we had like an official Peugeot team and an official Seat team. So there were a lot of like local manufacturers in Sweden involved in the championship. So I think one of the key factors for me to kind of my success was that I stayed so long in a front wheel driven car, and I really had to learn how to carry on the speed. And that's the advice I give all the young kids now, that don't move too quick to an all wheel driven car only because you have the chance, because you don't really learn the basics of driving and how important it is to hit your brake points and perfect line through the corner and carry on speed. Because if you start off with a Group N Mitsubishi, whatever direction you enter the corner, you just put the throttle and kind of pull you straight, and then you don't learn for me, the way to really drive rally.
When was the point in your career, Patrick, where you thought, okay, this is going to be a career? I asked Chris Atkinson this question, and he kind of said when the Suzuki thing happened for him was when he realized that this realistically now is kind of a career as opposed to a hobby plus. Yeah, and when I say hobby plus, it's serious, but you know, you still kind of, you know, technically you still got to earn a living as well to eat, basically. Although if you're sponsored by McDonald's, I suppose you've always got a Big Mac you can flip. But where was the turning point for you? Where did you think, right, okay, this is now a career?
I think that I told myself that very, very early. Like, I think I finished like school when I was 18, and I straight off got a full-time job as a salesman selling candy. And I think I did that for half a year. And then I realized, like, this is not what I want to do. I would like to drive rally. That's my passion. That's what I want to do. And I think from that day, I took a decision to make it happen. You know, the first 4 or 5 years, I was a taxi driver by night and pretended to be a professional rally driver during the days. So I think it took quite a bit of time for me. So it was more or less after I won the Junior World Championship, I realized that this can actually happen. Because all until that moment, we were always so on the edge to even get to the next race. Like, we never had money to test, and we always had to call all the sponsors twice or three times every year to ask for more money just to get going. And I remember before the last race in the Uni World Championship that year, it was actually Rally GB, and I had no money left, and I knew we needed like 20,000 euro more to go there. None of the sponsors were picking up the phone anymore. So I actually went to the local bank and borrowed the money. And I told them, you know, I just need the money because I'm going to go racing. I don't think you can do that anymore. But back then, they thought, okay, seems like this guy is on it. So I got the money, and then I did a rally and I won the championship. And that kind of opened up the door for me to something more than just found it from, you know, all the money that I was able to pull together.
Yeah, I think you timed that quite well, just before the banking crisis in 2008. I think yeah, you would have got a very different response a year or two later. But
I think so too.
Again, just looking at, you were another driver, of course, and you know, your relationship, I suppose, with Subaru kind of started when you started going over to China as well. You know, Chris and I spoke about this the other week. I keep referring back to Chris, but you know, there's some similar career paths here. And we were talking about a lot of European drivers that went over to China. And of course, it's a championship which you won twice as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I, at that moment, as my budget always was so limited, I took every chance I could to get in a rally car. And I remember me and Emil Axelsson, that was my co-driver for most of my career, we were driving something more or less every weekend. We had 1 year, I don't know if we did like 30 or 40 rallies, and it was everything from the Chinese championship to the Norwegian championship to races down in Serbia and Croatia, because we found some guy there with a car that wanted us to come and drive. And so I just felt that I need as much driving as I can get to just be better, because as I came from ice hockey, I knew that the only way to be better is to, you know, in other sports, work out more than the rest. And if you do that, in the end of the day, you would be champion. And I treated rally and driving the same way from the start, that I need to practice. I need to drive and drive and drive in different conditions, different cars. So the years in China, I think I really developed as a driver, because the roads over there are so different to the rest of the world, and you kind of just broad your band of different experiences. And I think that's very important.
I couldn't agree more. As I say, because we've had, you know, several drivers, of course, from these shores. You know, I'm thinking of, you know, Mark Higgins, Niall McShay, David Higgins. They all went over there, and obviously, and you know, and Martin Rowe, of course, who went over, who did PWRC as well. They all went over, and you know, the only downside, I guess, is that obviously the way the rules are over there now, you can't officially, it's got to be a Chinese driver that wins the actual championship, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think it's like that right now. They kind of changed that rule over and over. I remember the year when I drove for Subaru the year after they changed the rules, so it had to be a Chinese driver. So then I ended up in a front-wheel-driven Skoda Octavia. So I drove the championship another year, but in a front-wheel-driven car, because you could still win that championship. And then I think the year after they changed it back. So at the moment, I don't think there's a lot of Europeans there. I know there's one guy there called Kruna from Estonia. He's still there, but I think he's the only European right now. So I think it's in China, there's some years they seems to have crazy budgets and everything is possible, and some years they don't. So I think it goes hand in hand with that.
Just looking at again, I think it's naturally aspirated engines, Patrick, to be honest with you, for me. But I'm going to ask you about the Super 2 cars a little bit, because, of course, you know, you came into the Super 2000 cars just as they were becoming a thing, if dare I say, in WRC. But they were much, much bigger, of course, back in that period in IRC. And with IRC, you did several rounds of it, but did you come into IRC just as it was starting to change and just as it was starting to kind of get to the point where it was coming to the end? You know, we kind of lost the works teams in it.
Yeah, so my S2000 career started off, what year was that? Maybe 2008, I believe. So then I drove PWRC for Peugeot. And backed by Peugeot and Peugeot Sweden. And then at the same time, I did the Junior World Championship. So I did all the rounds, but in two different cars. And that was my first year. And after that, I got signed by Red Bull and Raimund Bamschwager to drive drive the Red Bull car, S2000 car, 2 years in PWRC. So that was at the same time as they were officially kind of starting to have their factory team in IRC, but we drove the other version of in PWRC. And then I went from there to IRC the year after that, if I remember right. So I drove quite a bit of those cars, and that was also challenging. And I think, again, the thing I had talked about before, that driving a front-wheel driven car, you really have to learn how to carry on the speed, and that carries over a bit to the S2000 cars, because you don't have a turbo, so you need to keep the revs up and really carry speed through the corners. So that worked out well, and I love these cars. It was so much fun to drive.
I don't think anybody realized how expensive they were to run, though. You know, when you think about what they were back in the day, and they were meant to be the second tier car, and people are trying to run them privately still to this day, and they get such a shock when the bills start coming in. I know a few people who own them, and you know, it can be just as expensive to run a Super 2 car properly is what it can be, you know, some Group A and World cars now.
They have come a long way, like with the R5 class now. That is actually more or less, okay, it's more expensive to buy, but the running cost is more or less cheaper than a Group N car. And the S2000 cars, they were just so expensive to run back then. And it took some time for everybody to figure it out. So I really like the R5 class. It seems to be a good class, and the car seems to be reliable, and you can do a lot of mileage now with them. So for me, they have come a long way.
Now, your relationship with Subaru, of course, and Subaru in America started, I didn't realize how you did an event, was the Squalor Hawk Rally back in 2009, something like that. It was your first event over in the States?
Yeah, I did. I was invited. Again, that was back in the day when I jumped on every drive I could get. So I was invited by a local small team outside New York to come and do an event for them. So I did. But we only came to not even the end of the first stage. I think we blew two engines on the test and then the third engine on the first stage. And so it was a little bit of a waste of time. But that was my first rally, and it was a good group of people and they were very kind. So I was a bit ashamed that I broke three engines in less than one day for them.
That's a good effort, though. That is a very good effort.
I know, right?
Now, the time with Subaru USA, and you know, again, you talked before about obviously going over there in 2011, and I guess over here in Europe, we've kind of been very aware of what's gone on with World Rallycross, and to some degree, Global wasn't quite on the same radar for Rallycross fans to some degree, because of what IMG did with their promotion, of course, as World Rallycross. And now that is kind of being extended into the American Rallycross Association with what you guys are now doing with Subaru USA. But you've been out in the States now doing Rallycross then for 7 years. So you must be kind of one of the longest serving drivers in the American kind of scene.
Yeah, so we are like the core group that's been there from the beginning is me, Scott Speed for Volkswagen, who else? Tanne Faust have been there all the time, Steve Arpin. So we are four drivers that sticked on there for quite some time now. And I think this is my sixth season over there. So I did the first 2 years with the Swedish Ford back team, OMSE. And then after that, I got a chance to drive for an IndyCar team. Brian Herda is his name. He drove IndyCar for a number of years, and then he started a race team. And he got into rallycross, and he bought an M-Sport Fiesta that I drove for 2 years. And at that time, I was one of the biggest rivals to Subaru. And after being with them in the paddock for, 3-4 years, they knew me quite well, and I knew them. And then before last season, we had a serious talk. Or actually, already a year before that, we started to talk about it and if we could start to do something together. But then they were locked up in contracts with drivers and different structures that didn't make it happen that year. And same with me, because I was also locked down in a contract. But yeah, for the year of 2017, then we made it all happen. And it was actually kind of a childhood dream coming true, because growing up, I was watching, Colin McRae and Tommy McKinnon in Subaru. And I must say, back in the day, the Subaru World Rally Team and the Subaru Impreza, that was my favorite car in the World Championship. I think especially because of the years of Colin and what he did. And so then to be able to represent Subaru on that level was really something, a highlight of my career.
Has it been, obviously, because you've been with race teams, prior to this, but, Chris was saying, he knows some of the guys from kind of his WRC days as well, that are, of course, part of a Mons sports car. Is it, Chris described it as much of a rally team that also does rallycross as opposed to the other way around. Has that made the transition into a team for you easier because you come from a rally background, would you say?
I would say so. And me and Chris Atkinson, we see things from the same angle, which makes it very easy. So we normally want the car to be set up the same way because we have the same kind of background. And also all the engineers, they have backgrounds in rally, all the way from Pro Drive to now the latest engineer that we got on board. He came straight from Toyota WRC last year. So we have some really clever people there. And also the mechanics, I would say the majority of the mechanics, they are American boys that lives up in Vermont. But then they also fly in another half of mechanics when it comes to the rallies, and that they are all experienced WRC mechanics that's been around for quite some time now. So it's really a good team. It's a lot of fun, and it's a great family feeling in the team. Vermont Sports Car and Lance that runs the team is a very good team manager and really good at creating this family feeling that you can really see that the boys feel as well, because they work so many late hours and they are so passionate about what we're doing. So it's hands down the best team I've been in.
Wow. Wow. What a great thing to say about a team. What a great thing to say about a team, considering all the things you've done. Were you pleasantly surprised when they asked you to say, go and do a stage rally this year? Was that a nice pleasant surprise for you over there?
Yeah, it was kind of in the talks already when we talked about me joining the team, and they saw then the opportunity to have four guys in the team that could do both. So me, Atkinson, Travis Pastrana, and David Higgins, that we were all capable of do both stage rally and rallycross. So I knew somewhere back in my head that one day that door will open again, which, rallying is still the biggest part of my heart. Rallycross pays my bills, but rally is still the more fun thing to do. And so when they told me before the season that me and Atkinson would share the car a bit this year. That was really, really good. And actually, my next event, I have two more rallies this year. So my next event in America is in 2 weeks' time, Rally Idaho. So it will be me and David Higgins there.
Okay. We know David. I know his co-driver quite well as well. We used to be teammates a few years back, Drewy. Have you got a set? You know, because one thing that David is obviously exceptionally quick on those events, and with the two pass recce, I assume you. Who have you got sitting in with you on this one, Patrick?
I have Per Anquist. He's I have had two co-drivers throughout my career. I had Emil that was with me for 7 years, but Per was the guy that was with me in the beginning of my career back in Sweden. And then he's been in and out with me when I have done like one-offs in China and Japan the last couple of years. And he did the first one with me, and we actually won that one, but we were a bit lucky. We were kind of on pace with David and the other guys on the first few stages. I think I was 2 seconds down on the first stage, and then they were running into some problems, so we actually won it. But as you say, David had so much experience from the stages over there, as he'd done the championship for 8 or 10 years now, and with two past recce and not being in the rally car on a daily basis, it's hard. It's a tough challenge. And David he's a really good driver, though. He's getting older, but I don't think people realize how good he is, because he's good.
No, he's because he's won so much abroad, and obviously he's a former British champion and things like that, but he just didn't quite get the opportunities perhaps at PWRC he probably deserved. But he went away and forged his career in places like China and the States, and he's probably a bigger name over there than what he is over here, which is, I think, a little bit sad, really.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So the Subaru community over there in America is just massive, and David Higgins is kind of the god, because he's been winning all the rallies the last couple of years over there. So he's been really, really good to Subaru, and he's very hard to beat there. But for the next two rallies that I'm doing, I'm kind of lucky, because both of those events are new, so we both have to start from a blank paper of notes. So maybe I can put a bit more pressure on it that way.
So there's two rallies to go. Are you doing the Travis Pastrana Nitro event with Chris as well?
Yeah. So I have four events left this year, two rallies and two rallycross events. So they are actually 4 weekends in a row, back to back. So we start off with the rally in Rally Idaho in 2 weeks. And then the weekend after that, we have the Nitro World Games, Salt Lake City. And then we have the final in ARX in Austin. And then the final rally, 2 to 4s, up in Seattle area the weekend after that. So it will be 4 busy weeks for sure.
Wow. So I'm assuming you're not commuting. No. Can I ask one last question before I let you go, Patrick? I'm really conscious of how much time we took. I really do appreciate it. It's a very cliche question, but out of everything you've done, out of all the events you've done, is the one that you kind of could pick out and go, if I could go back to that moment on that rally again, which one would it be?
Oh, man, that's a tough one. I don't know, actually. There were so many like fun stages and good memories from all the years in WRC. I would say Finland, though. Like I think I won Finland 2 or 3 times in PWRC and JWRC, and maybe not really the win, but the feeling in Finland when everything works. When the pace notes are perfect, you trust them to 100%, the car is just dialed in for the stages, and you kind of feel you're just playing a video game, because it should not be possible to go that fast with a car. And you, like, I remember with both the S2000 and the Super 1600 car, when you were just on the rev limiter and you just went into the corner and you knew that there's nothing more. Like, I'm on sixth gear on the rev limiter, so if this line is wrong, I'm done. but that feeling when that works, it's just an amazing feeling. So that was, I must say, that's kind of the highlight of my career when it comes to like pure feeling of driving. And then also last year, me and a friend built a Mark II Escort, full historic specs. I did the Rally Sweden last year in the historic class, and to drive a Mark II Escort on the Rally Sweden roads, that was also so much fun, because then it was kind of back to the basic of rallying, that you didn't have anything helping you. You didn't have an all-wheel driven car or a turbo or whatever. It was just pure power, and you had to hit your marks so much more precise to not go off-road. And when you rev that car, the Mark II Escort, that's a very special feeling as well.
Was Petter doing it as well that year? Because I know he's had the car built for the last couple of years. Like, he's done it as well. Did Petter do it with you?
He didn't do it that year. So he did it the year before and the year after. But so we built one Mark II Escort that we sold, but we just finished the second one that we will keep, also with all brand new parts and kind of same spec as Petter have. So if everything works out well, I would like to do Rally Sweden again, and hopefully we can get both Petter and Mikko Hirvonen and out there. That would be a lot of fun.
I hope so too. Listen, Patrick, I really do appreciate your time, and the guys at Subaru USA for allowing us to speak to you as well. They've been great, and listen, best of luck for what sounds like it's going to be a mammoth 4 weeks, and bring it home shiny side up.
Absolutely, that's the plan. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
No worries at all, Patrick Sandell. Thank you so much for joining us on Absolute Rally.
Thank you.
This is Absolute Rally, powered by the Kielder Works team. Cordless tools tailored for the world of motorsports. Developed from hands-on knowledge that you only get in the service park, not the boardroom. Kielder create products for their own use and like-minded people. Those inspired by mechanical motion and engineering. Plus, exclusively for Absolute Rally listeners, use discount code RALLY for 10% off at www.kielder.co. Simply search Kielder Tools online.
Welcome back to the final section of Absolute Rally, where we get all our any other businesses for this week. Hope you enjoyed Patrick and I's chat. We've just been talking about Patrick. Ryan's done a little bit of work with one Frozen Lakes in the past, but still, there you go. Another conversation for another day. Right, any other businesses this week? Boys, I'm going to go straight to mine first. We've actually talked about Irish Tarmac and what was going on in Ireland before. And it got me thinking about brothers. We've seen both the Moffat brothers out at the weekend. I think Josh Moffat, who won the Lakeland, which John Armstrong was talking to us about this week, and Sam Moffat, who won the Sligo stages. And it just got me thinking about brothers. There's the obvious McRae brothers. There's the obvious of the Higginses, of course, we've mentioned before. I was just wondering whether there's been any other brothers over the years, competitive, that have gone out and they've won rallies. And, you know, is anybody think of any other brothers?
Yeah, somebody you spoke to a couple of weeks ago, Chris Atkinson and his brother Ben.
Of course, yeah. But they, yeah, okay. I was thinking about drivers, but okay. Yeah, no, I'll have that.
Got the Higgins brothers, obviously.
I've just mentioned the Higginses. Jesus.
There was four of them.
Yeah, there was four of them.
And also Mum and Dad, that's what I'm talking about. Christine and Tony, remember?
Okay, no, good on you. I thought that was just very witty. But you were actually making
a joke, Tony, in fairness.
Yeah, I think it would have been very valid. Yeah, there you go. If anybody can think of any other brothers that are at a high level, tweet in, let us know. I think it'll be quite a good thing. The other thing I wanted to mention, by the way, is the mugs have started going out. I hope you enjoyed the ones who've got them, because we've already had pictures of people who've already received the mugs. The mugs are cool. We're already working on the next mug. I do think it's brilliant, by the way, that we're giving away mugs. And albeit with the help of Kielder, without them we wouldn't be doing it. It has to be said, but there will be a collection of mugs, and maybe you could call them Jack, Ryan, Tony, and Trevor. I don't know, but there will be the next car we're working on at the moment. Somebody did tweet an idea for a car, but I did actually point out to them the fact you've now gave everybody the answer. The fact you've tweeted it to us, but still, there you go. A couple of other bits and pieces I wanted to mention. I will be out doing the coverage for New Brighton, the Rally of 1,000 Cones this weekend. New Brighton Promenade is back, and live stream team coverage, and I will be presenting that and doing some commentary on that. So if you follow us at all and you're interested in a rally that we have mentioned, we've even got a picture of it on our Facebook page when it was around, of a Formula Rally back in 2001, one which Rye did. Did you do that, Trev, by any chance?
No,
you didn't.
I did it as a stage of Rally Wales a couple of times, I think.
Yeah, Euro Rally it would have been, Vauxhall Rally of Wales. Night stages on the Friday. Well, it is actually night stages this Friday, so I will be talking about stuff like that, because I'll be desperately trying to think of stuff, because I'm doing everything. I'm doing the commentary and doing everything else, so I'll be trying to come up with stuff. But still, there you go. So if you've got any ideas, boys, send me messages, because it will help. Last thing, very, very sad. I was with Peter Gwynne over the weekend, and we had a lovely catch-up, Peter and I. I know Peter from working in Rallycross and everything else, and, you know, then came the news of Bill Gwynne. And of course, if you're not, I'd be very surprised you're not familiar with Bill. Bill has owned a very, very successful rally school. Of course, all his sons were involved with it. And also very, very great competitor back in the 60s, 70s, even probably leading into the 80s. Unfortunately, the news came through this morning that he did pass away today, I'm led to believe. And I'm sure you guys have got memories and experiences, Rye, of working with Bill over the years and interactions with him.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Like you said, not only did he run a successful rally school, it was really the first rally school in the country that he became really well known for. But before that, obviously, from his own driving career, he was a multiple Motoring News Road Rally champion, and just a lovely, lovely guy. Always there with advice for everybody. Very experienced, very, very good at car preparation as well. I mean, I've recently been heavily involved with Ian, Bill's son, who's done some work on my car as well. And Bill would always come along to things like the Festival of Speed and be pedalling something very quickly. So he was still regularly in cars as well. And he'd had this fight for the last couple of weeks, and terrible news to hear that he's lost that fight, because like I said, a real rallying character and certainly one that's left a long legacy in the sport.
Trev, I think everything what Rye just said, obviously Rye had more interaction, but it was one of them, you know, Bill Gwynne was just one of those names, you know, you didn't need to say anymore, was it? It was just a name that everybody in rallying knew.
Yeah, I can see the image in Motor News and Mark II Escort, the Droop Snoop Mark II Escort. I think, as Ryan said, he won the Motor News Road Rally Championship a couple of times. What I didn't realise until I moved over here 20 years ago was how involved he was with ProDrive as well, and helping the drivers, certainly the customers who were buying the cars from ProDrive, taking them to the rally school and situations. And that's why you'll see a lot of comments from throughout the world about just how well he's respected, and just another one of the good guys gone.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Jack?
Yeah, unbelievable figure in national rallying, very, very key with even the rise of bars, the test and things like that, he was very involved with. And yeah, you know, he's one of those people who's just kind of like, I suppose you would refer to him something like a godfather of British rallying, really. One of them people who's been around forever and done many things, been involved with many different teams and many different drivers, and just someone, you know, for example, when I got my job, he's like one of the first people you give a call and, you know, get to know a little bit and learn a little bit about, and lovely family, lots of sons now involved in rallying, you know, thanks to him. And yeah, just a real sad loss to the community of rallying, really. Someone who was always willing to put stuff in, and very committed, and yeah, just he'd have time for anyone, which is, you know, more than you can say about a lot of people, really.
Yeah, very well put, Jack, very well put. Bill Gwynne there, folks. I suppose we move on now to any other business. Ryan, champion for you?
Yeah, my any other business came about through as we do. We tend to keep an eye on social media, see what's going on, what pops up on Facebook, what pops up on Twitter. And a couple of weeks ago, when I was looking down my Twitter feed, and one Hannu Mikkola was taking Ari Vatanen out for lunch in his Mercedes 280 that he bought back in something like 1971 or whatever it was, I think he said, with his first professional paycheck. And then 2 weeks later, he's going out to lunch with Timo Salonen. So my question to you three is, which world rally champion would you like to go out to lunch with? And maybe why? Go on, Tony, you take it away first.
I think I'd like to, I'm going to steal Jack's thunder. I think I'd like to do it with Sebastian Loeb. And there's several reasons. One, I'm not a big lover of French cuisine, but I'd like to be slightly more sophisticated. So maybe you could lead me by the hand, using Jack's term before, and into a nice French restaurant, maybe backflip over some tables to impress the crowds and myself. And, yeah, it's fair to say I'm comfortable in my own skin to say this now. I did have a little bit of a man crush, and he's got those steely eyes, which I could possibly look into while I at least have my starter. There you go.
Well, too much information at the end, but Jackie, has Tony stolen your thunder there?
Well, of course he has, but there's obviously more people I would like to go with. So I'd probably choose Didier Auriol.
To have lunch with you, mate.
Yeah, exactly. So Didier Auriol would be my choice, I think, merely for the fact that, you know, he's probably not the first person on many people's lists, but, you know, 94 was the first kind of WRC year that I ever got into, and he was obviously the champion that year. Very quick on tarmac, very spectacular to watch in the Celica Turbo, the four-wheel drive. So, yeah, I think I'd have some questions for him, and yeah, I think he's got a museum in France, which is very well full with some of the cars he's driven, Renault 5 Turbo, Lancia Delgen Squali, Celicas. I think he's recently added a Skoda to it as well, so hopefully he'd take me to the museum as well after dinner.
and you could ask him about his donkeys.
Yeah, I could.
Of course, donkeys, yeah. Okay. Yeah, there you go. Okay.
I could probably become one of them as well.
What, a donkey?
Yeah, one of the Oriole donkeys.
I'll be honest with you, Jack, I've read on the toilet doors that you never got a hope in hell of being referred to as a donkey. Trevor Agnew.
I would choose Walter Rohr, I think, just to really find out a bit more about the secret Group S project and everything that happened behind the Iron Curtain. That was really intriguing just before Group B finished. That side of thing would be great. He was over in Northern Ireland, of course, last weekend at the Deja Vu, organised by Plum Tyndall and Beattie Crawford. So he drove a 911 with John Mulholland co-driving him, who's the sponsor of the Ulster Rally. They did just a tour of some of the classic stages, such as Tor Head, did a gala dinner, and quite a few cars there. I think it was about 114 the entry list, and would have been good to be part of that, but I couldn't make it over. So Walter Rohr would be my choice ahead of Ari Vatanen.
I do like the fact, by the way, he had there was a photograph of him getting stopped by the police so they could take a selfie with him.
I thought it was brilliant.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant. I think the irony was is that the police car was on double yellow lines, and I thought, there you go. Where do we go next? We'll go to Jack Bennion.
Okay, well, I thought there would be quite a bit of doom and gloom on today's podcast, which turns out there was. I was very sad to hear about Bill Gwynn, and I was also very sad to hear about the Manx, which is probably, is it the favourite, my most favourite event I've been to? It's definitely in the top five anyway, so I was very sad to hear about that. So I thought I would tell my favourite story from the Manx in history, if that's okay with you guys.
Of course.
I might have told it before, but I like it so much, I'm going to tell it again. So today is Robert Drugman's birthday, if you didn't know this. It's unforgivable if you don't know it. Everyone should know when Robert Drugman's birthday is. Anyway, 1990 ERC champion.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so. So he did the 1988 Rally Isle of Man, which is my favourite year, which is when Patrick Snires won in his BMW. And there's some people who are very jealous of Patrick and his pace in the BMW, one of which was Fabrizio Tabaton, who was leading the ERC that year in 88. And Mr. Tabaton alleged that Patrick Snires had been getting illegal servicing and they had photo evidence. So he went to the clerk of the course when Patrick Snires was leading and said, I've got pictures of Mr. Snires illegal servicing and you should throw him out of the event because it's illegal and it's cheating, even though it never happens in rallying, as we all know. So by the time this film was developed, Snires had gone into a massive lead and Tabaton was very upset that Snires hadn't been thrown out and that he hadn't, you know, the organisers hadn't taken his word for it. And when they developed the film, it was actually Robert Drugman's car which was getting illegal servicing and it had retired that morning. So the £100 protest fee that Fabrizio Tabaton had to pay was not refunded by the organisers and the appeal was failed. And if that wasn't funny enough, even though none of you laughed, which I'm very disappointed about, the next morning, the team that runs ran Tabaton in his black and gold Delgen Squali, which was run by Grafoni, their service van crashed into a peat bog. And who was the only people who could tow them out? It was ProDrive, and they towed the van out after they'd protested them for illegal servicing.
There you go. There you go.
Brought to you by DKW, one of the most famous MN rally editors of all time, and very, very well known in rallying circles.
Quick question. Who owned Grifone?
Ooh. You should know that, Trev, because you drove, you co-drove one of their cars.
I do.
Yeah, John Jasper.
For Richard Habiton.
There you go.
Trevor Agnew, you're any other business, please, for this week?
Any other business? I'm very excited to see that Hugh Chambers has become chief executive of the MSA. Hugh Chambers, I suppose a lot of our listeners won't know, was one of the directors of ProDrive throughout the whole rally era, right into Formula One. Then he moved across to, I think, the British Olympic Association during, of course, the 2012 Olympics in the UK. And his current job, I think, is part of the governing body of World Sailing.
Yep.
So he comes with a wealth of experience, not just from the sporty side, but also the admin side, and more importantly, the marketing side, which is the main role at ProDrive. So you've got David Richards as chairman. You've got Hugh Chambers as chief executive officer. You've got David Lapworth in the technical committee, and Colin Clark supporting them at the minute. And so there's a fair big presence of ProDrive and ex-ProDrive people there. Some big challenges, of course, with the governing body and trying to get more people involved at grassroots level. But I can't think of a better man for the job, so all the best to him.
There you go. There you go. Last bit of info that I wanted to get out before we call time. Congratulations to Matt Edwards, of course, being on the show. He could, well, it's fairly likely now he will become BRC champion, I think. I don't want to jinx it, but he became BTRDA Gold Star champion last week. George Lepley became Silver Star champion, the R2 car, who has been absolutely rapid this year. Fantastic rally on the Woodpecker stages. Stage quality was fantastic. And thanks to the support from my co-hosts, we finished fourth in R2. There you go. Thanks.
How did you get on?
Badly. I think it's probably fair to say. No. To be fair, there was a fair few cars out.
People with a lot more seat time than you and done a lot more events this year than you have.
Yeah, thanks for you could write my book of excuses. Thanks. Ryan Champion's just a lot harsher than you, isn't he? He just couldn't wait for.
Well, all Jack does for a living is listen to drivers' excuses. So of course,
yeah, but to be fair, right, how many have you trotted out over the years? So
one or two.
Yeah. So there you go. But we had a good time. We had a good time. Stage quality, I have to say, was fantastic. It's some of the best stages I think I've done for a long, long time. And the quality of the stages has got better towards the end of this year. And good on organisers. And I was really impressed, by the way, with the reverse seed and front wheel drive at the front of the field. Don't think it played any effect on the rest of the rally other than getting smaller cars back out there, which can only be a good thing. Which I know David Richards is very, very passionate about, trying to get grassroots people back into rallying as well. So long may continue, but congratulations to those two on sealing their championship on the Woodpecker. I think they're both out on track rod come the end of the year. We'll be out on track rod come the end of the year. I'll be trying to get tips from Ryan Champion before the end of the year, or certainly the end of this month when the event is. And that's it for this week. So boys, thank you for this week.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Are we going anywhere exciting, Ryan Champion?
No. Although I am going to a TCR race this weekend. So we were on about R5 before. Obviously, a lot of the manufacturers have started building customer touring cars now with TCR. And Volkswagen Group, interestingly, I think they've got all four brands in there. So I'll report back on TCR next week.
Okay, well, we'll find out a little bit more. That'll lead in quite nicely to other things as well. So there you go. Trevor, are you going anywhere nice?
I'm not sure, actually. I just saw, I think it might have been Motorsport News, that Gary Jennings is doing a rally in northern France. It's only about an hour from Calais, so that'll take me about 2.5 hours to get there from here. So I might head over there for lunch on Friday or Saturday.
Oh, good for you. Good for you, Jack Benyon.
I'm doing the Great North Run on Sunday.
You
sound excited about it.
Good lad.
I am not looking forward to it. I don't feel like my preparation is as good as it should have been, or I've put a lot of effort into my preparation, but I don't feel like the result is what it should be. So I'm very I'm not
you
looking forward to
it. You need some time with Trev. That's what you need.
After the event, definitely.
No, I think before the event. Trev'll talk you around. Don't worry. Trev'll talk you around. We'll look after you.
Give you a call at 10 o'clock on Sunday, Trev, all right?
Just change the name of the Great North Walk. Maybe sort of.
There you go.
Then if you run some of it, you're ahead of the game.
What are you doing the run for, Jack Bengen?
I am doing it for Sporting Memories, which is a group that uses sort of weekly meetings to help people with dementia, Alzheimer's, people who are older and lonely, haven't got partners to speak to and things like that. So a very good charity that is also very much linked to motorsport. Tony Jameson Allen, who is one of the main people behind the charity, is a rally co-driver as well. And I'll be doing the run with Paul O'Neill, who I've sat with on the Neil Howard stages a few times on some little single venue rallies. So yeah, it's a good charity, and it's I believe it's a very good course, one very close to my heart. My granddad has dementia, so very much looking forward to raising some money for them.
Good man. And the link is on our Facebook page. If you've got some pennies or you want to support Jack, that's where you can go to do it. So thank you very much, folks. Folks, we do appreciate the download, and I think this has been one of our best seasons. It's been great fun so far. We've got two more episodes to go. Kielder have certainly brought something a little bit different. I've loved the back and forth over the fun we had with the mugs and things like that, and I think that's brought a different dimension. But without you guys, we would still be four blokes just talking bollocks. So thank you so much for the downloads, and keep please spreading the word. And if you can support Kielder, please support Kielder as well, because without them, we certainly wouldn't be here. Folks, we will be back same time, same place in the podcast hall next week.
Absolute Rally, powered by the Kielder Works team. Spread the word and download the podcast every week.